Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, September 16th, 2019. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism. From a conservative perspective, we invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com. We give you a few free reads, ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And in our studio here in New York, because we have our annual roast tonight, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Yes, she is not on Audacity. That's Skype. The Skype through Audacity, whatever. We have a whole, you know how long it took us to set that up. And now she's here, and so we don't have to worry about blending the two tracks.
Really peeling the curtain back here.
I'm telling you, it's the sausage factory is open for examination. You don't want to see what goes in it. Just like we don't want to see what went into the New York Times decision to publish this disgusting smear of Brett Kavanaugh that came out yesterday and actually came out Saturday afternoon. The first inkling that anybody had of the New York Times story on Brett Kavanaugh was a tweet that the Times immediately had to retract or make it or disappear that said, well, you know, holding on to a penis may be just, yeah, it's people's idea of harmless fun. But if a penis is pushed into your hand, the way Brett Kavanaugh's penis was pushed into a woman's hand, that's not so good. Or something. It was something literally like almost that.
And it's all fun and games until someone has his penis out, yes.
Yeah, and so it was deleted. And then it took 6 hours for them then to apologize for the tweet, but that was the beginning of 36 to 48 hours of shame for the New York Times. Not that the shame did not lead to, you know, a little impeach Brett Kavanaugh boomlet on the part of Democratic candidates for president and others who simply, I believe that the impeachment boomlet began 3 hours after he was in fact confirmed, as I recall.
Yes, that's true.
That he would be impeached as soon after he was confirmed. And
it has not yet abated. I asked a Senate candidate this morning if he supported impeachment based on this story, and he said absolutely.
Okay, so let's go through. So Christine has written a fantastic post about this that's on our website. Christine, let's go through the details of the story that is we all consider disgraceful, please.
So the Times piece, which was initially it was published in the review and opinion section on Sunday, which is something I think journalists and writers noted, because usually Times reporters who write books publish their excerpts from the books in the news section if it's a hard-hitting news story. So the fact that it appeared in the opinion section was noticed at least by people who kind of watch how the media does things. But the hype was that there was new evidence and there was new sources and an additional case that proved that, as one MSNBC host suggested, that here's now we have definitive proof that Brett Kavanaugh is a sexual predator. But of course, there was no such proof, because one thing that wasn't included in the original reported piece, but then was added as an editor's note, is the fact that the two journalists, Pogrebin and Kelly, had buried and not included in their excerpt the fact that there was no one who could corroborate the claims of this man named Mr. Steyer, who claimed to have seen another episode of Brett Kavanaugh revealing himself at a drunken party.
We should also say that this party took place 35 years ago.
As a Yale undergrad.
We're not even talking about how something happened within, after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Right. And the focus of their excerpt in the Times on Sunday was this woman, Deborah Ramirez, who many of our listeners will remember, made an initial allegation during Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings, claiming that he had, forced her to touch his penis when she was a Yale undergrad and that this was very traumatizing for her. There was no corroboration of her claims. The New Yorker, Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer, wrote a piece in The New Yorker that was ridiculous in its sourcing, couldn't prove anything. No one could corroborate this story. The Times, in fact, went on the record saying we could not corroborate Ms. Ramirez's story.
So the sequence there, if I remember correctly, is that the New Yorker was about to come out with this piece about Deborah Ramirez and this allegation, and then the Times, sort of just before the New Yorker piece was coming out, did a piece saying the New Yorker has a piece, but we have looked into this and can find no evidence. And the New Yorker piece itself basically said, we're telling you this, but we have no idea whether it's
true.
They
said that she had significant gaps in her memory, that she had to consult her friends and her attorneys over the course of 6 days. And after that series of ruminations, she finally came out and decided to make these allegations.
Right.
But she herself could not corroborate them.
Right. So this new allegation comes not from the woman who supposedly had Brett Kavanaugh's penis thrust into her hand, which I don't want to get clinical or graphic here, but the logistics of how such a thing would be done.
A lot of passive voice.
That you would thrust that someone else's member into a third party's hand. Which
John
McCormick,
by the way, at the National Review has a great discussion of the logistical challenge.
I mean, he would basically have to push his tushy forward to have it land in a third party. I mean, it's so I only bring this up to say that there is something comic about this allegation that, you know, like, unless all you want to do is believe any story that is told you, you would go, wait a minute. Like, how did the penis get into her hand? I mean, that is like sort of like logic 101. So this guy, so Steyer apparently was telling people this story. Here's how I read between the lines. Mm-hmm. Steyer, who is a lawyer who was Hillary Clinton's lawyer during the Watergate matter, before, you know, with Congress, negotiating with Congress over Hillary's testimony on Whitewater, and is now to be considered wonderfully nonpartisan because he runs something called the Center for Nonpartisanism, told somebody that he was at Yale and he saw this. And then apparently the Judiciary Committee and the FBI attempted to get, he would not say so.
Nor would Ramirez respond to Senator Grassley's efforts to reach out to her during the confirmation process.
Right.
They invited her many times to come in and talk to them, and she would not do that or provide corroboration of her story.
Right. Okay. So the Brett Kavanaugh story is that somebody named Max Steyer saw Brett Kavanaugh's member somehow being thrust into the hands of a woman who has no memory of it happening.
Correct.
Okay. That's it. That is the new allegation. A third party remembers 35 years ago that at a drunken party, a naked guy in the middle of a room had his member thrust into somebody else's hand.
Can we call it penis gate? Because it just feels like
right.
That's where we're
now,
headed.
Now, what Kavanaugh said,
I can
either about this or about the Ramirez thing, can't remember, is if this had happened, it would have been the talk of the campus. Now, I was on college campus.
And
in
the New York
early
Times, the piece said that apparently it was. Said it explicitly in that piece, but didn't confirm in any subsequent details.
How was it
details
the talk of the campus?
That it was.
They just
if it had been the talk of the campus, 100
as a
people,
fact.
100 people who had gone to Yale at the time would have been able to say last year, oh yeah, I remember hearing this story about Brett Kavanaugh and at a party naked, and you know,
or
like,
when he was being vetted for a federal judgeship. I mean, there are many points
along his career
where this could have come.
Christine Blasey Ford came out and all that stuff was coming out. There were 6,000 people on the Yale campus. It was the talk of the campus. You know, I remember things happening when I was on campus that I heard about, that if somebody, you know, not that I don't think there was anybody famous and particularly famous in my class, but I mean, if if there had been and it had been involving something like this, of course I would remember, and so would 150 other people, and that would have been the end of
Brett
Kavanaugh.
To support the point, the story says that, well, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people came out in support of her in after these allegations were made and made her feel all good about herself because she was sort of the odd person out.
We're now
in this
talking
class.
About Deborah Ramirez, Deborah not Ramirez. The woman who is the who is at the Steyer's center club, of the yeah. new rumor, whose name we don't know, who says it either right. didn't happen or she
so all of those
remember.
People discovered their foreknowledge of Deborah Ramirez and their fondness for her, but can't recall the details of this story.
Wait, no, and I'm getting confused now. Wasn't Deborah Ramirez herself the one who didn't quite remember it until,
yes,
until
also,
it took a few days yes. of, I forget what the
there were significant
consultation.
Gaps.
Consultation. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That, great that,
with her attorney.
Yeah. That then yeah. suddenly refined her memory of it.
We
yeah.
should also add two details from Molly Hemingway's writing in the past mm-hmm. week. One is that Christine Blasey Ford's father went up to Brett Kavanaugh's father at the country club and said he was happy that Brett Kavanaugh had been confirmed for the Supreme Court. The second detail was that the other woman at the supposed party where the 15-year-old Christine Blasey Ford was supposedly assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh said that she didn't believe the story.
So this is
her name is Leland Kaiser.
Leland Kaiser. So this is in that book, the excerpt of which was published in the New York Times. And this appears to be some real original reporting, as they got her on the record for the very first time. Mm-hmm. She had only spoken to the FBI, never spoken to a reporter on the record, and on the record said none of these details add up.
The story doesn't even ring true.
And there's some more revisionism about this thing. Everybody's saying, well, of course they didn't speak with Republicans in the Judiciary Committee. They were adversarial. But nobody remembers how much they bent over backwards to accommodate Dr. Blasey Ford.
Nobody remembers the fact that until 3 days before any of this, and certainly right after Christine Blasey Ford came out, that the general betting line was that Kavanaugh wasn't going to make it through. I mean, you know, then she had her morning where she, you know, gave this beautiful, chilling, you know, was so heartfelt and all that, blah, blah,
questions
blah.
Questions by neutral attorneys on the recommendation of her attorney, Deborah Katz,
yeah.
and among other things. Right. And there were, they wanted a variety of other things. But
then
they gave
Kavanaugh
a lot of what
came
they asked.
Out and was, you know, you're destroying my life is now destroyed. Congratulations. None of this happened. It's all a lie. Everything is a lie. And then it was very touch and go what was going to happen. Like, and it all came down pretty much to Susan Collins deciding that she believed Kavanaugh.
Well,
and thus, by the way, Susan Collins deciding she believed Kavanaugh has imperiled
her
Susan Collins'
yes.
re-election chances. So when people look at Susan Collins say, you know, why aren't senators brave? Or so you think Susan Collins didn't know that by doing this she was setting herself up for real trouble in her re-election in 2020? Of course she knew.
But isn't this really an effort on the part of Democrats in particular to they're not just going to have the impeach Trump rhetoric now. It's impeach Trump, impeach Kavanaugh, you know, attack Senator McConnell. They have these three white dudes who they can kind of that will draw fire for them. And the impeachment threat for a Supreme Court justice is a new line of attack.
Impeach Earl Warren was a big line in the 1950s after the Brown v. Board thing. There was a whole grassroots Earl Warren, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the 1950s.
But this court is really poised to thwart a lot of the progressive agenda, and that's obviously something that concerns progressive
activists.
But
Brett Kavanaugh isn't the problem there.
Agreed.
Another thing is that Democrats have convinced themselves that Republicans love Brett Kavanaugh, always adored him, and that wasn't the case until he delivered his testimony in that confirmation hearing right after Christine Blasey Ford, where it came out really forcefully in his own defense. Before then, Republicans were really lukewarm on the guy, and he's demonstrated in his findings proportionally, I think it was SCOTUS blog that found proportionally in percentage terms that he's sided with the liberal justices mm-hmm. as often as he sides with Neil Gorsuch. Right.
Well, if you remember, there was a whole idea that it would be good. There was a certain crew on the right that said it would be good
right.
if Kavanaugh had to withdraw, because then Trump's own impulses would be he would really appoint. Then he would appoint Amy Coney Barrett, and then they would really be sorry, because Kavanaugh is a squish and Amy Coney Barrett is Savonarola.
But to what extent here do you think that the actual goal is to actually unseat Kavanaugh, or to just keep this fight alive, to keep this message out there.
It's science fictional to remove Kavanaugh. It takes 67 votes in the Senate.
So isn't it about getting this, you know, keeping this accusation alive about him specifically and about there being white male predators who are sort of, you know, wreaking havoc through the halls of power.
But Abe, does that benefit Democrats? I mean, it feels like the gun issue where the mm-hmm. enthusiasm is disproportionately on one side of the issue.
I
don't know. I think it's hard to tell. I mean, I think it'll be a fun. It could, you know, anybody can be, you know, juiced into fundraise, you know, giving dollars because they go nuts. And so you could throw this out to people who don't understand how the process works and who, you know, a Supreme Court justice has never been impeached.
Samuel Chase was. But
oh, he was. Excuse me. I mean, okay. So Supreme Court justice, you know, takes 67 votes of the Senate to remove him. I mean, theoretically, maybe the House could impeach him. Maybe. I mean, on the basis of what?
Right.
Literally on the basis of what? I mean,
isn't it an acknowledgement by Democrats that the slow walking on Trump impeachment has led to a kind of impeachment fatigue and they need a new target? I mean, I think Abe's correct that there's, as a strategy, because people don't understand the details of the process, it's like, okay, well, we can't get Trump right now, or maybe we can, but it's very complicated. And let's go get this guy because he lied about pulling his penis out as a college student. That they can glom onto. It's a much more salacious story that is more emotionally reactive than emoluments,
I guess. Yeah, although, yeah, you know,
but that's so just unserious.
I think what you have is, in 1991, Clarence Thomas was appointed to the Supreme Court. This late hit allegation by Anita Hill, which I continue to believe entirely without foundation. I know now you're not allowed to say that for some insane reason. Thomas confirmed 5248. He has been on the court for 28 years now, almost 28 years, and he does not care what you think of him.
Don't you know he has an asterisk next to his name? All of his decisions are asterisks.
He does not care. He told me once that he, in 1992, ceased reading the newspaper, except he read the New York Post sports section, which he really enjoyed, and he stopped reading the newspaper, and he gets his new, he talks to people, he watches some TV, he doesn't really need to know what the news is as it happens, and he will not allow those people who hate him and who lied about him to ruin his life. And the question now is what Brett Kavanaugh is going to do emotionally, personally, for, you know, about this. And I would say that, you know, as a long-term strategy to getting, to having some kind of sway over a Supreme Court justice's opinions, returning to the same well of character assassination, is the sort of thing that will push Kavanaugh to be more like Thomas and less like Roberts. So as a strategy for liberal governance, it is a disaster. As a strategy for virtue signaling, hysterical groveling to, you know, I don't even know what you would call it.
I mean, doesn't this dovetail, though, with like the efforts to say we need to repeal the filibuster when you have Senate Democrats in the minority mm-hmm. benefiting from that condition? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to do what you're doing from a position of strategy. It really is just throat clearing.
I have to say, I think, just to go back to the Times for a second, I think one of the extraordinary things about this is that the Times has to weigh in its calculus, okay, we're going to take a hit on credibility here. There's just too many holes in the story. They'll back it up, they'll do whatever, but okay, we're going to take a hit on credibility, but we'll trade it off for getting out this message. That's an amazing thing.
Okay, here's...
Or you're saying they've got a good, tight story?
Before, John, you jump in here, yeah. I don't think they feel like they're going to take a hit on credibility. If this were to happen to the left, Dean Baquette would be out there with an apology and an explanation as to the editorial failures that happened. You know why that would happen? Because it's happened twice in the last 3 months. I can remember the E. Jean Carroll story and then a story before that where the left jumps on the New York Times for failing to report the narrative they prefer. And the Times editorial team is very apologetic about it and very explanatory. You haven't heard anything along those lines.
Oh, no, I'm not saying they'll cop to it publicly. Saying the internal
I don't think they feel like they're taking an editorial hit with credibility because they have been pandering to an audience very explicitly for the last year.
I say, I think Noah's absolutely right, but I also think Abe's right. And I'll give you my, I'm now about to do rank speculation here, but they deserve it. And I don't care whether they care, and they won't care. But here's my speculation. Robin Pogerman and Kay Kelly have this book. The general, as Christine mentioned, the general order when full-time reporters for an organization write a book on the topic that they were covering for the paper, that they are allowed to develop new sources and new reporting. But when the time comes for the publication of the book, the paper gets first crack at revealing the hot new nugget. That this is a standard that was basically created by Bob Woodward's books and his relation to the Washington Post. So the Post gets four excerpts from, you know, finds whatever the great nuggets are, runs them, and then this both sells the Post and sells the book. And that's the way it's been for 35, 40 years with Woodward and the Post. So in this case, they have one nugget, apparently, because according to Hannah Rosen, a writer I revile because she wrote a really nasty profile of me once, but she's reviewed the book for the New York Times itself, and she says in her review they have no new, they didn't get anything.
No smoking gun.
No smoking bud, no friend who says that it's changed on Kavanaugh, whatever. There's nothing. Okay, so that's the Times's critics' own review of the book by these Times reporters. So it appears in the opinion section. Why? This is my rank speculation. They finish the book. Time says, okay, what have you got? And they say, we've got Deborah Ramirez, and we've got this stuff that went on at Yale, and we've got something new about Yale. And they go, great, what is it? Well, there was another woman, and Brett Kavanaugh's penis was thrust into her hand. Really? Oh, my God. Who is she? Well, either we don't know or we won't say, because she won't come out. Really? So how do you know? Well, there's a guy named Max Steyer. And he says that he heard or he saw that this happened, and he actually told people about it at the time. But when the Senate Judiciary Committee called him to find out what he knew, he wouldn't say anything. So then they say, okay, so what you're saying is you have an allegation by a woman whose friends say that she either doesn't remember or it didn't happen, and all you have is a witness who is not clear, it's not clearly a witness, who is actually a partisan Democrat who was Hillary Clinton's lawyer, who wouldn't go on the record with the Senate, either on the record or on background with the Senate Judiciary Committee with this allegation when it really could have gotten Brett Kavanaugh. And then Kay Kelly and Robin Pogerman have to say, well, yeah, that's right. And then they say, well, we're not putting this on the front page. What are you, crazy? We'll put it in review, because then we've got plausible deniability because it's in the opinion section. And somehow, in the course of this process, the exculpatory fact that she doesn't remember this having happened, the supposed victim of Brett Kavanaugh's
new victim of the thrust member,
wasn't in the story at all. Why wasn't in the story at all? Because when you edit for opinion, you can. I mean, I've edited for both news and opinion. There are different kinds of, it's not a reported piece in that case. And so it's kind of an argumentum. And, you know, argumenta do not require that you provide the evidence that destroys your argument. That's for other people to do. That's what it means to write polemic. So effectively, this is published as a polemic, not as a news story, though it's a reported polemic. So they kind of leave this detail out until it turns out Molly Hemingway, yet again, apparently the only person in America who has seen a galley of this book or somehow got a copy of it, says, hey, you know, the book itself hides somewhere in the back that the supposed new victim has no memory of being victimized.
But they also touted it I mean, they kind of touted this as both the book, which was evidently heavily embargoed, which Hannah Rosen mentions in a review, as if it had a bombshell new detail. Yeah. It's been marketed as having bombshell new details, even in their, you know, and I think that's in part why the tweet that the New York Times got in trouble for promoting the opinion piece, it's all meant to lead the reader to believe that there is some new evidence. And it's why a bunch of ridiculous Democratic presidential primary contenders immediately jumped on and said, yes, there's a new woman out there, impeach, impeach, impeach.
I was getting flashbacks while you were recalling all this, and I didn't know why. It was just weird deja vu, and I remember reading, I was rereading the New Yorker piece, the original New Yorker piece that identified who Deborah Ramirez was in the first place, and it acknowledged that they could not confirm with other eyewitnesses that Kavanaugh was even present at the party. The witness that they had was a classmate who heard about it from another classmate. So they had no eyewitnesses, only this like tertiary witness, which is essentially the same thing with this one. So the Times protected its whatever credibility it had with the Deborah Ramirez story and then threw it away on the exact same mistake.
Right.
With this story.
Right.
Well, this was the best tweet so far I've seen about this whole debacle was the person who tweeted, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the person's handle, but basically quoted directly from the line of the Ferris Bueller movie of the girl who says, oh, well, my boyfriend's, you know, cousin's third, you know, friend who happens to know so-and-so heard that Ferris passed out at the ice cream parlor and it's really bad. I mean, there's a version of telephone going
so
on
let's,
here.
So basically, here's the story. The Ronan Farrow Jane Mayer story last year should not have been published. The New York Times story that attempted but could not confirm anything in the Farrow Mayer story should not have been published because they couldn't confirm anything. This allegation should not have been published because there's nobody in the New York Times, in a book, on a blog, in a tweet, out of somebody's mouth to somebody else's ear. This is an infamy. And it is a sign of, you know, I don't think the Times is going to be hurt for the very reasons that Noah delineated, which is that they are no longer playing in the field of, they are lying back on their reputation of being the most august news organization in the world. But they are playing in a world in which their reporting, their analysis, everything is actually supposed to be in service of a new kind of agenda. That if that had been implicitly true 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it is now explicitly true, which is what the tweet revealed, which is that there's a 24-year-old social media person who understood perfectly well what you were supposed to take away from that story. That initial tweet was the story, and the removal of the tweet is like, here's the story. Okay, you know, we shouldn't say that. But that doesn't mean that we retract the story. It doesn't mean we apologize for the story. Then we also, 24 hours later, can add the denial thing that was missing from the story as an addendum at the bottom in italics to cover our asses.
After the damage the story intended to make all along was done by getting all those Democrats on TV and on the record saying impeach Kavanaugh.
But those Democrats should be furious.
Yeah, I agree.
They should be absolutely livid.
They've been totally had.
All right on a limb. The limb is sawed off from under them.
But the limb wasn't sawed off because if there are no consequences, if we live in a world in which there are no consequences for these kinds of actions, if in fact Elizabeth Warren raised another $200,000 yesterday after she did the tweet that, or, you know, $1 million, then why, what's the limb? What limb was sawed off?
Well, eventually one of these candidates is going to be the general.
Who are we? Who are we? We're not part of the, you know, 3 million people who subscribed to the New York Times after 2016. We know what happens when they try to get balanced. When they try to get balanced, half their, you know, the entire world of wokedom comes down on their heads and cuts their heads off, and then they apologize profusely in meetings where Dean Paquette, who is himself, has to grovel before the two-year-olds who had never even read the New York Times and have only read Up Rocks.
So as we speak, the backlash to the backlash is
good.
Brewing.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know, but that suggests if that is the trajectory of events, then there should be a backlash of cultural Maoist revisionists in the millennial workforce in accounting who are demanding that there be some sort of accountability from editorial for failing to stand by this woman and her credible claim. Mm-hmm.
But they have stood by it. They just didn't. The question is whether they're accused of not standing by the tweet. That's, I mean, ultimately, when you get down to it, it's all about the tweet, isn't it? I mean, the tweet that they deleted, which is the heart of the story. Oh, yeah, it's all in good fun when you're at a party and someone puts a penis in your hand, right? Well, now that guy's on the Supreme Court. I mean, this is, you know, it's like we, some of us spent 2016 saying, oh, Idiocracy is coming, right? I mean, that the what happened, how the Republican nomination devolved and everything, that Mike Judge's weird, brilliant satire about what the world would be like if America went down this present course 500 years from now, being run by people who barely had any vocabulary and, you know, didn't know how to build, buildings were falling down because they didn't know how to do anything. And so some mediocre guy from 2006 ends up being the smartest person in the world. Right, so we had this whole thing about it. Idiocracy is coming. Well, the left wing idiocracy is coming. Like the dominance of news organizations and the news media by these vicious idiot kids is idiocracy in a different realm. The realm in which you basically say, "I don't like that guy, so I'm triggered by him, so destroy him." Or you get to work at the New York Times, and what do you do? The first thing you do is you yell at your boss. You know, like if Abe Rosenthal were still editor of the New York Times, whoever yelled at him would have been buried 6 feet under in the Port Authority, in the subway station under the Port Authority. And now Dean Baquet is, you know, groveling, sniveling, cowardly, suck up, you know.
Well, and for every single one of those stories that we do know the details about, how many stories of self-censorship by, you know, kind of moderately minded reporters at the New York Times do we not hear about or know yeah. about? We just, that is what long-term concerns me, is not just the groveling by the leaders, but by the things that never get written, reported, mm-hmm. or said by people who are of well-intentioned journalists, but know what the landscape looks like now.
And that is the purpose right. of the Maoist Cultural Revolution. It's not just to demonstrate that the leaders, the ineffectual leaders of these institutions, will kowtow to you out of fear, because that's what student radicals learned in the 60s, and it's what these kids in the media are learning about Jeff Goldberg at The Atlantic and about Dean Baquet and all that. But it is the make a false move and we'll come after you, you know. Be like Barry Weiss and we'll come after you. Be like Bret Stephens and we'll come after you. Write an article about, be George Packer, who a big liberal whom, and somebody else I don't really like, who wrote a big piece in The Atlantic last week about what he learned to his sorrow about the power of the public education blob in New York City and how it was destroying his kids' schools and the schooling altogether, and then you basically just get accused of being a counter-revolutionary and having your hat handed to you. And, you know, I that wouldn't bother me, but I'm sure it bothers the hell out of him. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, it's like you have to be Kevin Williamson, which is to say that A, you don't care, and B, your deepest principles are connected to not giving in to the mob. To live through one of these things. And so the idea that you could incur that wrath is what turned the entire academic, the professoriate, into this, you know, miasma of mediocrity and you know, cultural suck-uppery.
We should all know that we're operating on two very distinct logical tracks here, because we're all operating under the assumption that the story is blown up, is debunked, and doesn't really have any effect on the national conversation. The people who believe it continue to believe it. This just in from leading millennial Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez: it is unsurprising that Kavanaugh, credibly accused of sexual assault, would lie under oath to secure a Supreme Court seat, because sexual assault isn't a crime of passion. It's about the abuse of power. He must be impeached. So there will be no reflection on the details of this story. It is just another vehicle to... And I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez genuinely believes this. I don't
sure
think this is
does.
A vehicle
I,
for power
most
for her.
People that I know who believe that Kavanaugh did what he supposedly did
genuinely,
to Christine Blasey,
honestly
whom I
it.
Do not believe... I do not believe her story. I think she is a liar. I think this was a political
hit. You and her father both.
Right. I think she's a liar and all of that. But, most people believe it. Here's the interesting thing, which is that word, the adverb in that sentence, right? Which is credibly accused. Now, everybody used that. I think we probably used that term the day of the Christine Blasey when we were talking about this on this very podcast, because she was so startlingly poised and touching and all of that, because, you know, even an amateur actress can be a good actress when the stakes are, you're either going to be really bad or really good. It is not a credible allegation. None of these rises to the level of credible in this sense, which is that Christine Blasey Ford was only credible because she was emotionally accessible as she was making the claim. She didn't know where the house was. She didn't know who else was there. We now know that her best friend who was there with her does not believe it happened. And these other two allegations are not credible. No one saw it. No one was there. Two people heard it. One of the people who is now newly alleged doesn't remember it and doesn't believe it happened. This is called, these are not credible allegations.
Indeed, the credibility.
Credible allegations require subsidiary evidence.
Now, the credibility is established by the existence of other credible
right.
accusations. These accusations, unsubstantiated allegations, substantiate the previous allegation.
Yeah. And as to the whole question of why would anybody do this, the answer is because they were trying to stop somebody from being on the Supreme Court for life.
Well, and that's an important point, because I think what the public hears and feels, more importantly, when they listen to Christine Blasey Ford tell this story, is very different from what the process should be, right? And up until recently has been. So factual investigations into credible allegations is one thing. But as I think the Democratic strategists who push Ford in front of the cameras well knew, her emotional appeal trumps all of that.
Right.
And in that sense, that the process has come down to that. It's even much more dramatic than it was when Anita Hill was testifying. I mean, there was a lot more. It just felt like a passion play at this point, rather than what it should have been, which is a confirmation hearing.
Well, okay. So you remember that Ben Wittes of Lawfare wrote a thing about how he knows Brett Kavanaugh, he likes Brett Kavanaugh, but Brett Kavanaugh should not be confirmed because, look, we don't know if it's true or it's not true, but, you know, you don't get to be on the Supreme Court. Like, somebody else should be on the Supreme Court. It makes me uncomfortable that he might be on the Supreme Court.
That
even though I
have
no,
yeah.
right? So this is a very key thing. It's like, someone raises an allegation. You want it to be true because you don't like the guy for some reason, or because it dovetails with various other Me Too interests and stuff like that. And then you allied into the argument that he should be denied his place on the Supreme Court.
He said that Ben Wittes said he couldn't defend himself because, quote, Kavanaugh cannot blame or attack or seek to discredit a woman who purports to have suffered a sexual assault at his hands. If he did, he'd be no better than Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, and then he did, and he got onto the Supreme Court. But I mean,
but by the way, right. but do you remember all the attacks on Kavanaugh
yes.
that
right.
day?
Yes. He was yeah. how dare he even defend himself?
He was so explosive. His mm-hmm. anger.
Yeah,
no one with that kind of anger should be sitting
on the court. Anger. So he's a there were whatever the allegation was, it shifted. So he shouldn't be on because he was a drunk. He drank too much and he behaved this way at parties. Except he said he
as
didn't
a teenager,
drink too, right? But then he said. He didn't. I mean, he likes beer, but no one ever said that he was a drunk. He was never a drunk. Okay, so, but he was a drunk. And I know because he went to Gonzaga, and those boys, was it Gonzaga? Went to some Catholic school, and those boys were they were not good. And, you know, I know because I went to Madeira, and they went to Gonzaga. And then there was that, and then so he was a drunk. So then he was too angry. Mm-hmm. And then the third was, you know, yeah, that you were supposed to believe her because you have to believe all women because women have to be believed. It's so hard to come out and do these things and testify, and it's just so terrible. Because now, granted, she got death threats, which is disgusting, and, you know, it's she also became a hero and a national figure and is going to win awards for the rest of her life and speak at things and probably gets $25,000 a speech. And so, you know, it's not unmixed what, you know, what can happen to you. But the whole point is that the core root here was, let's get him. We don't really care what the argument is. He shouldn't be on the Supreme Court because I don't like him.
But the anger thing has been brought up again with the with this new story. I see a lot of the reaction as well. You know, when the credibility of the story was was questioned, it was, yes, but remember how angry he got? The anger, the go-to anger thing. And again, I think this is an attempt to link him to Trump, right? I mean, there's this idea of these angry, privileged white males controlling all access to power. And that appeals to the young, woke, you know, progressives who are going to be voting. Well,
yeah, because, you know, none of them is ever angry.
They're angry for the right reasons,
yeah,
John.
Yeah, they're never angry. No one's ever angry. You know, I mean, so I think in the end, you know, there was an interesting thing that, again, Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino, who wrote this book about Kavanaugh, have said, which I think is worth exploring, which is the general feel was like, ha, 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 he made it. You know, you went after him and you went to try to destroy him and he's now on the Supreme Court, so screw you, right? And they say, and I think with some, they say, this is not right. Like, we saw a giant effort at unprincipled character assassination with no evidence to go behind it, and it almost worked. And it is a warning shot across the bow of every human being on Earth that says that you can say anything about anybody, and if you get a mob behind you, then, you know, if you don't have the resources that Brett Kavanaugh has, either the emotional resources, the personal resources, the family resources, or the fact that you knew that Trump, he knew for some reason, although, you know, wasn't going to pull the rug out from under him, that your life will be ruined.
There's an effort underway to impugn the Justice Department, which is providing an award to the legal team that that shepherded Brett Kavanaugh through the confirmation process. That is, for some reason, untoward. I'm not entirely sure why, but just the existence of that process is supposed to make you really angry.
Right. Isn't the complaint that usually they give this award to people who've prosecuted long, you know, years-long important federal cases, and now they're just giving it to the people who helped Brett Kavanaugh?
It's just to trigger the libs.
Right.
But,
right.
And imagine. If it is just to trigger the libs, so what? By the way, I mean, that's part of the whole... That's part of the whole dynamic. Like, every now and then there are these moments where you're like, well, you know, if this is what we're devolved to, then yeah. So the libs are triggered so much that they are now going to fundraise off of this preposterous idea that you can impeach and remove a Supreme Court justice on the basis of the non-allegation of a Clinton lawyer.
And by the way, this chapter may not be over because these stories come in clusters. And when one hits the press, someone says, oh, yeah, I was at a party. You know, I mean, even though...
I don't know that. That's why this is so unbelievable to me, by the way, which is that the time for the cluster to hit was when he was like a bull in Pamplona with five sticks in him. You know, you need the sixth and seventh stick to kill him. Right. And that was when you were going to see that happen. Like, it doesn't matter now. There's nothing they can do to him now except make him feel terrible and make themselves feel terrible, by the way. Now, then the other thing is like, oh, well, you know, people say this is then there's weird stuff about how Kavanaugh didn't help Trump in the midterms. So this doesn't matter. Noah, can you?
Well, it's true.
I know, but I still don't understand what that has to do with anything.
I'm trying to think like somebody who would think in those crass terms. But I mean, as you know, crass politics as it is true that there's a bit of an incongruous nature to the claim that, well, Republicans were unified and ignited by this like nothing else ever, and then 6 weeks later they proceeded to lose one of the biggest landslide midterm elections in history.
But they did win. They did gain two Senate seats.
Well, I mean,
but do you remember that there was a change? Because I believe the Kavanaugh stuff sort of crassly did help Trump at the time. But then there was the administration's response to the caravans, which washed over.
That's exactly right. The midterm closing election from the administration was not Kavanaugh, and it should have been. It was immigration.
Now, it could well be, though, that it helped in the Senate, and that's important, say, for 2021 for Republicans, because that four-seat margin may be what saves the Senate for the Republicans. They might lose in 20. If it had been two seats, they might actually have lost three to to go into the minority. That's one thing about it. But even so, I don't understand. Well, there is this.
I am though. Of the mind, though, that this will not resonate in 2020.
Okay, but here's what might resonate.
Because this is A, old news, and B, that's 14 months from now.
Okay, but here's what might resonate, okay? We have the court on a knife's edge. We have Ruth Bader Ginsburg having just gone through her fourth bout of cancer, about to be 86 years old. Stephen Breyer is 81 years old, okay? So the likelihood that the second term of Trump will see one or two Supreme Court, new Supreme Court nominations could be, for the first time, the kind of rallying cry for Democrats, maybe, that the Supreme Court has been for Republicans forever. The courts have been a major issue for Republicans for decades. Democrats have never had to run on the courts. They've never run on the courts. They don't talk about the courts.
They do now.
Now.
Well, it didn't come up in the debate last week. A marathon three-hour debate last week.
Yeah, but that was ABC's fault.
Well, but it's also the case that no one, when we should, and we should say clearly that when we're talking about someone like Ginsburg or Breyer, we're talking actuarially, not hopefully, right?
No,
so this
hopefully.
Is why I think a lot of them don't like to bring this up, because it sounds like they're, you know, assuming.
Well, look, I mean, Scalia dropped dead in his bed. I mean, you know, it's not that that can't happen, you know, and then created that. But I mean, Democrats did not rally around. They rallied around Merrick Garland, but I mean, they did not say you have to vote for Hillary Clinton. Reason number one to vote for Hillary Clinton is they're going to get that Supreme Court seat, and we got to get that Supreme Court seat. They're like they said 82 different things. Every major speech that Trump gave from February 2016 onward, he said judges, 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 because that is something that conservative Republicans understand is the sort of the linchpin of the, you know, that if Democrats dominate the courts as well as the media, as well as the universities, and have all of the sort of, you know, the high ground of opinion and opinion policymaking in America, that, you know, conservatism is finished. So liberals need, this is my question, will this be something that they say we have got to be in the White House?
They would have
because
to.
they are gonna kill every last progressive proposal in America. It'll be, you know, we'll be back to the Stone Ages with this court.
You'd have to very seriously contemplate RBG's mortality, which I don't think is something anybody wants to do on the left.
You remember that whole thing when people started saying that she maybe wasn't as great as everybody might have thought because
somebody had a wonderful.
She should have retired when she got her second bout of cancer in 2014, so that Obama could appoint
her
successor.
Right after Trump was elected, somebody had a great observation the other day that this hagiographical cult around RBG really sprang up as a result of the fact that she'd started losing all the time. Like, she was there when she was writing exclusively dissents, and she never wrote a concurrence over the last, like, whatever, how many of her years. That's when people started making this cult around her in order probably to compensate for her lack of relevance.
Well, and the fans of the cult are young, many of them young feminists who likely have not read many of her opinions or know her jurisprudential. I mean, she's a classical liberal. I mean, really, she's not a woke feminist by any means. No. And a lot of the respect that moderates have for her in terms of, you know, the law and her approach to it as a sort of feminist icon is that she is not extremist by any means.
No, that was the centerpiece of her great victory that she scored that basically made her a major American legislator and led to her eventually hitting the Supreme Court, was that she sued for sex discrimination against a man. That was her big case. The case that is the centerpiece of the movie about her is how she applied equal rights law to a sex discrimination case brought by a male. That was considered. It was, you know, theoretically planned to have this effect. And it was a sign that she is somebody who wanted to make larger arguments and apply them to, as opposed to, you know, she's a wise Latina, so she should be appointed because she represents, you know, Latina women who have diabetes or whatever. So now if we shift gears to the fact that there's about to be a major war in the Middle East. There's about to maybe a major war in the Middle East. So who wants to, Abe?
Is that the consensus?
No, Abe? I don't know. No, I said no, there no, may no. be. It no. just said there might be. I mean, or the war began on Saturday. Or it began 6 months ago with the first taking of the
we should go back to the oil tank.
All right, so what's happened is that there was an attack on two Saudi refineries by drones taking out a huge chunk of their oil production. But what this really is, this isn't the start. It is one step in an ongoing escalation that we've been watching now for at least months.
Right.
Having to do with the downing of freighters.
Really brief history lesson. May of this year, it started. We got some uncorroborated warnings that there would be some activity from Iranian proxies. The administration moved a lot of anti-air assets and some air assets and about 1,000, 2,000 soldiers into Iraq, a deterrent force. Proved out to be prescient. And the month later, there was a sophisticated state-sponsored attack, according to the states who were targeted, involving four oil tankers, two of which were Saudi-flagged. They were disabled. About a month after that, there was another attack on a tanker. A U.S. drone was downed, and Iran claimed responsibility for that attack. There was another tanker that was taken. And this morning, there has been another tanker that was taken. Piracy in the Straits of Hormuz is epidemic. And then this follows, obviously, a dramatic escalation with the attack on these Saudi refineries. And all of it can be linked to Iran. In fact, the administration is saying very explicitly that it's not even the Houthis, however you pronounce it, in Yemen, which is an Iran proxy militia, or the Shiite militias operating in Iraq, that this is not a proxy event, that this was directly attributable to Iran emanating from Iranian soil, and the response should be proportionate.
So where does this, and then there's a lot of confusion here because the administration's hardest line person on Iran was fired or quit or whatever last week. Following which we had the Secretary of State say that the president was prepared to meet the head Ayatollah in Iran without preconditions, a statement that was said on air during a press conference, you know, aired to all of America. And then Sunday, Donald Trump said that it was fake news. He never said he would. No one said he would meet Iran with preconditions. So we're back.
And he said it multiple times.
We're back into the I don't know, the crowd count at the right. inaugural or something where, you know, there's a great scene. There's a movie called Billy Rose's Jumbo. Jimmy Durante is trying to steal an elephant from the circus, and he's pulling this elephant behind him. And then somebody says, you know, what are you doing with that elephant? And Durante says, what elephant? Anyway, so let's remove Trump from the equation or the tweets for a minute. What the United States has taken it as an axiom for decades that it was basically an American obligation to the world and to ourselves to ensure that the supply of oil to the civilized, to the world itself, was not disrupted. Like this was actually explicit American policy, and, you know, led to a very famous article published in Commentary in 1975 by Robert Tucker about how theoretically it was possible that at some point America would have to seize the Saudi oil fields in order to protect them from these oil embargoes. That the first oil embargo that the Saudis put in place was so disruptive and threw the world into a recession, and that maybe the United States should contemplate seizing the oil fields in Saudi Arabia in order to make sure that the Saudis would not be able to throw the world into a depression. So that was, you know, 45 years ago, 44 years ago. But nonetheless, this has been an American position, implicit and explicit, that we would do what was necessary to ensure that the oil flow of the world was not receded. That was also
mining the Straits of Hormuz.
That was also one of the reasons for our invasion of Kuwait.
Right.
For taking Kuwait back from Iraq, which is that the Iraqis were going to control too much of the world's oil. And in fact, they set the Kuwaiti oil fields on fire and all of that. So here we are. Donald Trump is a non-interventionist, clearly does not want to go to war with Iran, would prefer to make some kind of a deal with Iran. Is Iran forcing his hand?
I think only to the extent that Trump, I think, does understand the seriousness of global markets. And so this hits him in a place that he might not be able to ultimately be frivolous about. I mean, it's not about human rights. It's not about this. This is, I think, something that he can make some very simple sense of.
Well, what's changed in the last quarter century is that the kind of financial shock we would experience from such an attack on the global oil supply out of the Arabian Peninsula has not occurred. We have experienced, there was a 17% jump in the price of Brent, and the markets didn't collapse because the world oil supply chain has changed dramatically.
Yeah,
United
guess
States
why?
Is a supplier. Right.
Not if Elizabeth Warren has anything to do with it.
But that seriously reduces the strategic imperative to intervene when global oil supply chain is interrupted in the Arabian Peninsula.
That's exactly right. In an odd way, we're put in a position where we would be doing this to protect China's and India's oil supplies. I mean, that's what, you know, we, in theory, not that this is the way the oil market works, but in theory, we are on the verge. We're 6 months away from being a net exporter of oil, the United States. So in theory, if there's some kind of a crisis, we can resort to our own oil and, you know, sort of like commandeer it for the market. Trump has announced his intention to release some oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in order to stabilize markets. So
that, by the way, is really bad parochial policy. Should not be considering our desire to intervene in crises like this based upon whether or not we will feel the shock at the pump. That's a terrible policy. We got this attack because we declined to respond to the last six, and the next attack will be worse.
Yeah, no, I agree. But my point is, it is something that would make sense to Trump. Whereas everything up till now, he could shoo away. Well, I don't want to escalate.
The administration's position has been that we are trying to destabilize this regime from within with diplomatic and financial tools. And we don't want to interrupt that because that's exactly what the regime wants. They want a pinprick strike on command and control, so, you know, anti-aircraft, what have you, that they can rally the populace around, get a quick juice out of the public because they're suffering. There have been rolling protests for the last 2 years.
Right. But so there are two ways of looking at the Iranian attack, assuming, as I think we all do, and as Mike Pompeo said without qualification, that it was an Iranian attack, is that either A, they are in fact trying to draw us into something for their own domestic reasons. B, they are trying to put another, as I said about the Pamplona Bulls, like they're trying to put another stick in Mohammed bin Salman, who as some of the larger sort of like we can never deal with him again stuff around the murder of Adnan Khashoggi sort of dissipates. And then they're doing this. What do they want from us? So one's about us, one's about the Saudis, and it's very, you know, confusing.
Well, there was the idea that they were, you know, continually lashing out to get us to offer them a better deal, right? They want, we're going to be a big pain to you until you sort of come talk to us, give us what we want, and then we'll restore the illusion of peace.
Well, and in that sense, it plays to what they understand about Trump's psychology, right? Because the guy who always wants to make a deal, have the big televised moment where he meets with the authoritarian, you de-escalation is a process of many small negotiations and trade-offs, and there's no big handshake moment. Even if that's the policy we should be pursuing and currently claim to be pursuing, they must, in some way, that provocation of Trump is a direct hit on his ego and unfortunately, hopefully will not yield the response.
Right, well, so that's the question. Are they playing a North Korea card? They're escalating in order to get him to say, write a letter to Rouhani that he can then get a letter back and say, I just got the most beautiful letter from the Ayatollah Rouhani.
Right.
On the other hand, he really does seem to hate the Iranians. I mean, I will say that unlike some of these others, like he does have some kind of a gut, dislike of the Iranians, the way he seems to have a gut like of the Israelis that is, led him like Thursday of last week to really try to drag Bibi Netanyahu over the, over the finish line tomorrow in the new Israeli elections by announcing, that he was considering a defense treaty with Israel, which is a,
I don't think so. Absent this event, I think he probably would have had a sidelines meeting with Rouhani in Turtle Bay next week.
I think he still may.
Right.
Why can't he? That's the whole point of these. Pompeo says it's this, that. Then he says we're still locked and loaded and we're standing by and ready, but we don't really know what did. I didn't say no preconditions. And then next Wednesday he'll meet with him on the side. One thing you can say is that this total inability to understand what he's doing, in the long term, is a horrible foreign policy strategy. But in the short term, does have the advantage of having them stand there saying, what the hell are you doing? Like, what is he doing? Is he going to blow us up or is he not going to? I don't know.
Madman theory.
Right. Yeah. What's that, that cowboy Reagan? You don't know what he's going to do.
Also, the awful thing is that if he does meet with Rouhani, no matter what happens or is said in that meeting, he will come out acting as if we are on now a new road to peace,
right,
with the Iranians. And we'll have to deal with that false reality immediately.
It's just a kind of, everything is revert. It's very hard to follow at times the mindset of the authoritarian, because what you assume in most negotiations is that when somebody wants to negotiate, they even consciously or unconsciously, even if they want to harden their position so that they're in it's harder to they make you move to them and not them to you. Nonetheless, the idea is you have to kind of like ratchet things down a little bit just so you can sit at the table across from somebody and not spend the first half hour saying, what are you doing? Why are you blowing these? We're just sitting there. You're blowing these tankers up. Like, what the hell? What's the matter with you? That's not how they think. It's like the classic problem with the Israelis and the Palestinians, which is the Israelis are like, we're ready to meet with you. And it's like, okay, we're just now going to go and kill 200 people in a terrorist attack. It's like, why? How is that? In the end, we're not going to be able to make a deal with you. It's like, okay.
I mean, there was a lull following the downing of an American drone,
mm-hmm,
that wasn't followed on with a series of, follow-on attacks. And that was when the president started thinking aloud about meeting with Iranian officials. So the cool-down period took too long, and you spike up tensions again, and then you wait for another overture.
But by the way, I think Trump might do something forward-leaning here. I mean, something militarily in the maybe not-too-distant future, because he's also smarting from having chickened out of the strike last time.
The drones, the
right,
strike.
Yes.
Right. So if people remember,
after they got rid of Bolton,
they were there.
That
was
would just be too cruel.
150 people. Right.
Yeah.
His
right,
brand is not humanitarian. Yeah,
there was a pinpoint strike that we had authorized after the drone was downed, mm-hmm, and apparently it was locked and loaded. And when somebody told him that 150 people might die in the attack, he pulled it out.
Right. So now this is
pulled out of it.
This is a this is a direct response to that in some sense, some reading, and it makes him look ridiculous.
Well, it's the classic. It's like you know, you procrastinate today, you have twice as much work tomorrow. So, but, you know, he doesn't abide by these commonsensical theories. You know, like, if you don't do something now, you think this was bad. Well, you know, wait till they blow up an American, you know, blow up 1,000 Americans in Iraq. I mean, not that, you know, or, you know, do trigger some.
Oh, there wasn't a threat to a civilian airline, wasn't there? That the president and the administration thanked Iran for not killing a whole bunch of people. That's a vague memory. I think I blocked it out.
But strategically, from a domestic political standpoint, it's always tough if you're if you've run on being a kind of quasi isolationist, but also a tough guy. I mean, he's constantly having to balance that. I mean, going into an election year, no president wants to start a war or even a small bit of trouble in another part of the world. And particularly for Trump, I think that's not a message. He has enough self-knowledge to know that's not a message he's going to be able to sell.
Well, yeah, it was the message that he should be selling, or should have, you know, if he were able to sell any message that was positive, would be that, you know, we've taken major efforts to kill off ISIS. You know, that was supposedly the story 2 years ago a year ago.
That one's foreclosed on.
Why?
ISIS is coming back.
Okay, there you go.
Testifying to the effect that ISIS is reconstituted.
They got bin Laden's son. Like, there was that little... they tried to promote that.
Then they'll get him his nephew, his grandson. I mean, I don't know. But anyway, just to close out, because I did mention this just before, but, you know, Israel has this election tomorrow. And I will say that... the last week has been very interesting because if Bibi Netanyahu does not improve his position from the last time when he really couldn't, he needed one more seat on the right in order to get the majority, and he was unable to do it and basically, you know, killed the government off so there could be a new election before the president of Israel asked the second party, blue and white, to try to form a government, which it unlikely it would have been able to do either. But, you know, he just had this flurry of activity in the last week. Met with Boris Johnson. He met with Putin. Trump made this offer. You know, he made this offer for a possible defense treaty. He announced an intention to annex Area C, which is in which there are almost no Palestinians living except in the city of Jericho, which would be exempted from this annexation. He just shows what you can do with power when you have it, and quite acting quite creatively in that sense, to remind people that he, as prime minister, has been kind of a visionary as a foreign policy, not security prime minister, which is the relation with the Palestinians, but foreign policy prime minister expanding out Israel's connections all over the world. And then you have sort of these really embarrassing arguments that say things like, well, he shouldn't be meeting with, you know, Orban and the president of Poland and all that, because they, you know, there are credible allegations of anti-Semitism, about which one would say that then Theodor Herzl shouldn't have met with anybody trying to set up the Jewish state to begin with. If this doesn't work, to basically make him look like he's a very big deal, and the guys he's running against in blue and white and others, really in blue and white, are just kind of like also ran schleps who don't know what the hell they're doing, then he probably really will be finished. I mean, because that's the best argument he can possibly make, and they can't just keep going on like this forever. So it'll be interesting to see. He got 36 seats last time, or 35 seats last time. A kind of like the Nate Silver of Israel is now saying his final prediction is that Likud will get 38 seats, which would mean that he could get to 63 and thus have a majority. So that could be right or it could be wrong. These polls are ridiculous, by the way, in Israel, because they have 500 people responding about 12 parties. So, you know, it's like if you go from four people saying you're going to vote for a small party to six people saying they're going to vote for a small party, that party suddenly gets into the Knesset. You know, two people or three people. So the polling is not... The polling missed the last poll. The polling average before the last election had Likud and Blue and White splitting 30 seats each, and Likud got 35. So the polling is not good, and so we have no idea what the heck is going to happen. You're not supposed to end up something by saying we don't know what's going to happen. So I will predict that Bibi gets 37 seats. And then don't remind me of this if he doesn't. I'm just predicting because I figured we should end on some kind of predictive note. But then I get everything wrong. Although I got the 2018 election right. I think I said 40. I'm just saying.
I'm going to go back in the records and check on that one. I don't remember.
I know I said 40 at some point. I think the day on Twitter, when I was on Twitter, I said 40 that like 2 hours before the polls closed.
So this is the moment in like a serious television where the voiceover comes in and says, on Thursday, we will find out if John Podoretz was correct.
It's a cliffhanger.
Oh, dear God. Okay. Well, anyway, with that, it's great to have Christine in the studio. Too bad she lives in Washington.
I think that all the time. But
oh, well. So for Christine Abed, no, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.